Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Into the Mythica, Wisdom and Secrets from Our Primordial Past. I am Jocelyn Starfeather, and I am excited to be here with you once again today and absolutely thrilled to be with Dr. Tarya Ward, my dear friend. Welcome, Tarya. Thank you so much for being a part of this event.
Thank you, Jocelyn. Thank you for having the event, because I've been so enriched by it already, and I can't wait for the rest of it. So.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Well, Tarya and I have created so many things together over the years. And yeah, it's just an honor to have you here, Tarya. So let me go live on YouTube. And while I'm doing that, everybody, please go ahead and put your name and location in the chat so we can welcome you in. And I'll get us all set up on YouTube. All right, here we go. So we're live on YouTube now as well. Welcome everybody over on YouTube. Please put your name and locations into the chat too. We have Dr. Tarya Ward here and so excited to dive into your topic today, which is false doors. So let me first though, I will read your bio and just introduce you to everybody, Tarya, and then we can get started. Okay. Tarya Ward, PhD, lives in Asheville, North Carolina, where she has a private practice offering dream analysis, psychological and spiritual guidance to clients from all parts of the world. Tarya has worked intensively with her own and other people's dreams for more than 45 years, and for nearly 30 years, she has been an avid student of Indigenous ways of knowing and being. Tarya has conducted a monthly global dream symposium since early 2017, wherein people from all over the world come to share their dreams and listen to the collective dreaming mind. Tarya conducts retreats and vision quests, teaches online courses, and teaches to a wide audience in regular interviews and lectures. She offers private oracular readings upon request. So your topic for today is false doors, ancient Egyptian portals to other worlds. And Tarya and I were recently both in Egypt together, and there are so many doors of all kinds in Egypt. So this is such a fascinating topic. So could you begin by sharing with us, what are you referring to with this term, false doors?
Yes, I'm happy to. And first of all, I just want to say I've been listening to your beautiful interviews, and I am not a scholar, just so everybody knows. I am not a student or a scholar of all this Egyptian wisdom. I have so loved your teachings, Jocelyn, that you've done on this and others. And Veronica Goodchild yesterday had beautiful information about Egypt. And Patricia Iwan, oh my gosh. So if you haven't caught up on those, you know, I hope people will get those. So I'm mostly talking about my experience in Egypt, not necessarily very well-versed. I went as a friend to Jocelyn and a friend to Veronica, and we all decided to go, and they kind of invited and encouraged me. And so I came along not knowing much about Egypt at all, or you know, knowing some of the things that, you know, that are kind of basic to know about Egypt. But just with that said, I am not coming from a scholarly perspective, but from more from an experiential story that I have to tell about all this. So Jocelyn, if you would start to show the slides I sent of the false doors.
Absolutely. Let me bring those up here for everybody.
First, show that one that's the purple-ish one.
Okay.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Okay, so when I went to Egypt, I went a couple of days early because I wanted to get over the jet lag before the group came, and I needed to be a little more rested. And so on my very first night in Egypt, I went out to the patio and had a quiet dinner all by myself. And across the patio, I zoomed in on this. So this was a little distance from where I was sitting, but across from the patio was this image. And I don't know, something internal was happening to me as I sat and had my meal and contemplated the sort of fact that I was breathing air in Egypt. I was looking at the sky from Egypt. I just almost couldn't even settle myself into the reality that I was in Egypt. And here I was, and this that looked like a door or some kind of portal just kept, I don't know, there was an energetic connection that I had with that entire night. And so I later came to realize more why on my very first initial sort of moments in Egypt, there was something addressing me. And this, if you'll show some of the other images, I can explain a little further what I came to understand. Oh, this was another one. That little dark post there looked like a portal to me too. From where I sat, I zoomed in on this, but from where I sat, that looked like another little portal with a light on the top of it. So both of those portals were like in a very very really powerfully energetic way were addressing me.
That's so interesting with the little light in the post too.
Isn't it? Yeah. When I zoom in on it, you can kind of see that it's a post, but from where I sat and with my particular eyesight, it really looked like a portal. I felt drawn to it in a sort of a mystical way. Yeah. So keep going. And then after everyone arrived and we started our visits to the various sites, Jocelyn, you had a beautiful picture on your presentation of a false door, but we began to see in all the different sites, almost everywhere, these that narrow passage there is what they call a false door. And it's in the Egyptian architecture and art, just everywhere. And it seemed like my psyche that night when I was in that first night was drawn to those portals. Everywhere we went, I was just drawn into these portals. And what is their story, or why are they riveting my attention in this kind of way? And so the false door, you can keep moving a little bit. These are just my photographs. They're not the best photographs in the world, but these are other examples of the false doors. You just see them everywhere, all through the Egypt Museum and all through Saqqara and all the different places. And there's that light. I'm just noticing that right now. Veronica was talking yesterday about that light that just happens in Egypt. So there's that beam there. So in ancient Egypt, these doors were understood to be portals through which the dead, those who have passed on, they can come through, and they would put food at the bottom of them to feed their dead and to invite them to say, you know, we're here, and here's some food for you. And so it was a very interactive kind of exchange that was happening. And the idea was that the seeker can go through those portals. Your physical body clearly can't go through the portals, but that we can enter into the land of the dead through those portals ourselves. Our bodies can't, but our what they call the ka body can go through those portals. And I'm thinking of quantum physics, you know, even in quantum physics, you know, that sort of quantum aspect of ourselves can go through into the land of the dead or into the other dimensions in these kind of ways. So that is the concept. And as I was watching them and thinking about them, well, one of the first experiences I had just in my first two or three days there was Egypt and the teachings that I was getting from Patricia. If you haven't heard Patricia from yesterday, I encourage you to hear her. But I started to realize that everything that I have assembled in my life that I think that I am trained in, that everything I think I know, all the experiences I've had, everything that, you know, all the, I have gotten a PhD, I've worked with shamans from all over the world. I have trained in the world's religions. I was a minister for 20 years. I trained in dream analysis. And, you know, I have such a vast sort of history of different kinds of ways of understanding the world that we live in. And suddenly when I was in Egypt, it's like all of that shrunk to nothing. And I thought, I know nothing. Whatever all that is, all that I've spent 70 years of life coming to think that I understand and know is nothing, that it's all, it's all, for some reason, the image comes of when you go up into an attic and there are a few little trinkets on the bottom of a coffee can, you kind of rattle the coffee can. It's like all my information, all the things I think I know are like that stuff that's rattling in the coffee can. There's so much more. And everything I know is such a limited, tiny, tiny version of what there is to know. And for some reason, Egypt was just like blasting me open in that way. And it was not disconcerting. I mean, I guess it was a little bit disorienting. But on the other hand, it was like, oh, wow, I get it. So then I realized that going through these little doors here, it's not really as much the body that can't go through, it's the mind that can't go through. If we're going to go into these other dimensions, we have to drop everything that's in the mind. The mind, all of our concepts and ideas and identity and assumptions and impressions and all of that, erase. You can go through there if you let go of absolutely all of that. So that was a very experiential thing I was having. It's like, I was very drawn to these doors. I wanted to know what the ancient Egyptians knew about them, how to be in relationship to them. Why were they calling to me so much? And it was more about the mind than the body that I was understanding needed to be let go of. And this reminded me of an experience I had, I think it was in 2018, Veronica Goodchild and I were in a crop circle. Was it 2019? Anyway, I lost in time, clearly. So just not that long ago, Veronica Goodchild and I were in Glastonbury, and near there, a crop circle occurred that we could enter. And I went into the crop circle. I was like, I was just shaking with excitement. And the first thing that came to me, and that's been coming to me really like a thunder ever since, is don't think. Just don't think. And my mind, I'm a thinking type, so my mind was wanting to do all these things, and the sort of the voice that was there, the sort of bigger than me voice that was there, was don't think. And so here I am in Egypt, and it seemed to be the same thing. It's like, don't think. There is something beyond thinking here. And if you're thinking, you're limiting it. And so I felt really compelled to listen to this guidance. I wanted to mention too that Patricia, who was the tour guide that we were with, who is so knowledgeable, she was saying that her teacher, Hakim, how do I say it, Jocelyn?
It's Ayan. I've been saying Iwan, but I think it's Ayan.
Ayan. Okay. Yes. So Patricia, excuse us for slaughtering the name. But anyway, Hakim, her teacher and her father-in-law, she said that she mentioned that he said one of the hardest things he ever did was to unlearn everything he had been taught at university. And that reminded me of Buckminster Fuller, who many of you who know me know I talk about him all the time. He was a mentor of mine growing up. And he said the same thing. He came to a point in his life where he said that the only thing he could do to start to make sense of his life was to unthink everything he had been taught to think and to not use words. And for 2 years, he went into silence and did not use words. He tried to not think, not use words. And he said only then did he feel like he could begin to think his own thoughts rather than the thoughts that were being pressed on him by his education and the culture and the sort of collective mind and so forth. And David Bohm, who I also studied his work quite a bit, he said the self that we have is just a collection of thought. And as we know, thought can change. So we have these thoughts or ideas about who we are, but if we change all that thought, we're something else. And we can change, we have the power to change that. And he was the father of quantum physics, so he really understood the physics of all this too. So I just wanted to mention all of that. And also, I often mention these quotes of Einstein's that I absolutely love. He says, "I have never made any discovery by logical thinking. All the knowledge came to me in moments of silence and moments of synchronous insight." And he says, "I think 99 times and find nothing. I stop thinking, swim in silence, and the truth comes to me." So, Jocelyn, will you show the globe slides here now, please?
Yeah, absolutely. It's tough for me to get them side by side. I'll do one at a time if that's
side by side. Just show one and then the other. Yeah, that one. Okay, so this is the globe, the Earth, as we generally see from space, the way that they present, you know, the beautiful vision of our planet. This is our Earth. Now show the other one. I saw this one recently and it just blew me away. This is the other side of the planet. This is our planet from the side of the Pacific Ocean. It's all water. And so I think of that busy side of the planet, all the thinking side on the other side. That's what we're always looking at. This is the side where there are no words there. There are no thoughts going on there. There's only, you know, this primordial life that is happening there. And if, as we, you know, are coming to understand, we are the Earth. And so the Earth is us. We are, you know, cells in the body of the Earth. And this is the side of ourself that we've kind of forgotten. This vast, silent, primordial, pre-words, pre-culture space is us. And we're so focused on the cultural aspect or the busy incarnated aspect that we kind of forget that this is who we actually are. And just not that long ago, just over the summer, I was at a friend's, she had just purchased a new property and wanted me to come help her sort of bless and consecrate the land for the work that she wanted to do there. And we did a shamanic journey. And in that journey, it was kind of surprising, but in another sense, not surprising. I was taken to that place on the land, to, you know, on that land, back to the time when there was no organic life on the planet. There wasn't even cell division. None of that was happening yet. It was like there was not life yet on this planet. The planet lived a long time before life showed up. Mm-hmm. And I was taken back to that. And I knew that the planet was inhabited by spirits then, and that those spirits are still here, and that we can communicate with them. So that primordial life of the planet is still ours, and that primordial life of our own, this aspect of us that was here before all of this activity that we see on the other side of the planet was happening, that's all still in us. And it's most of who we are, basically. The largest time of life on this planet is that time of quiet before life entered. So all of this was coming. And I love this, what Patricia, one of the things Patricia said when we were at the pyramids at Giza, she mentioned we had been to all these other places where you see all the beautiful hieroglyphs that they've been showing us. And she said, "Why do you think that there aren't hieroglyphs anywhere in the pyramids here?" And she said, because her understanding or her belief or her thought is that the pyramids were built before we had language. And they were built at a time when we didn't need language. We were able to speak through the heart. So I just love that thought. So all of that was coming to me in my first days of Egypt.
And then you said something very unexpected happened.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. I will tell you more about that. You were at least or an outsider witness to what was going on internally here. Yeah. So I was, as you can see, very excited, very enthused by my experience, and loving all the sights, loving the teaching, just so into it. And then all of a sudden, like almost in the, you know, in a very quick way, I was abducted into this, I don't even want to call it an illness. That's what we thought it was at the time. We thought I was getting sick. And that's all I knew how to describe it. I was all of a sudden just sort of losing life force. I didn't have it. And I remember sitting with you, Jocelyn, we were sitting in a restaurant and I said, is it like a refrigerator in here? Why is it so cold in here? And you said, it's not cold in here. And I realized I felt like I was refrigerated. I was so cold. And then as this progressed, I started having shakes. I was shaking and cold. We didn't know exactly what was happening. I didn't know if this was going to last a couple hours or what was going to happen. But as we went into it, it ended up being something that was sort of taking over my experience, was able to go the next day to Abydos by just lying down in the back of our van and just resting as much as I could, and then getting up as we did things and saw the beautiful temple there, got to see Veronica. That was kind of a miracle just because I was hardly able to, you know, move or walk that day. And then the next day, I just knew I had to surrender. And so I did. And it was in those next couple of days when I spent the days in bed, just completely drained of life, that I came to understand that this was something bigger than me. This was something really even not an illness, though Patricia was, you know, really thoughtful enough to have a doctor come and visit, but he looked over everything. My lungs were fine. I had no congestion. I had no heart things. I had no anything. He couldn't find anything, but it was clear that something was happening. And I had no life force. And it was in those sort of those hours of silence and quiet and just being completely drained of energy that I started to understand that this was something that was designed for me and that I really, really had to surrender to it. And it felt like I know the myth of Persephone, who in the Greek myth of Persephone, how she was just playing in the field and picking flowers, and all of a sudden Hades just grabbed her and abducted her to the underworld. I had that image for what was happening to me. I felt like I was having so much fun. I was so excited. I was having all these experiences, and then whoop, I was just abducted and I was in the underworld in a kind of serious way. And then I came to realize that this was similar to, this was over a few days. I'm kind of fast forwarding here my perception of all of this, because it was, you know, it wasn't in the very beginning that I was able to realize what I'm about to describe now. But it was over the days that came that I began to understand that this was similar to an experience I had in 1997, which was also in Africa, where I was abducted into a rite of passage that I only, you know, after it was over, came to understand had been orchestrated for me by my guides, by the spirits, by whoever sort of conducts the overwatching of my journey in this world. And I wrote about that in my dissertation. It was like a very well intentionally planned, thoughtful rite of passage with all of the elements of the rite of passage that the indigenous people speak of, absolutely every bit of it. But it was planned for me, not by living guides, but by the invisible guides. And it was perfect. And this was happening again in Africa, which I think is interesting too. 20 some years later. So I began to surrender into this, okay, this is a rite, and I just need to understand and trust what was happening. And I could tell you that there was a point there when there was no life force in my body. I don't even know if I was breathing, because that would have meant life force. I didn't have any. And I remember at some point, I got up and tried to go to the restroom and I couldn't even make the steps. I thought, well, maybe I should eat something. So I took a little like chia seed bar and I tried to take a bite. I couldn't even, taking a bite was more life force than I had. I couldn't have swallowed it. I couldn't have digested it. I was like, something was happening there where it was a death state. And then, so, okay. I'm trying to figure out how to tell this story. As you can tell, it's a very kind of wordless story. So at some point here, I decided I needed to go home. It wasn't clear how long this was going to last. I felt it was a drain on the group, you know, to be worried about me. And that, you know, I didn't know if it was going to be another day or another week. And that at some point I just needed to say, okay, I'm going to get a plane home. And so I woke up one morning and that's what I did. And Patricia was so kind to get me on a plane from Luxor up to Cairo that day so that I could go home. I changed all my flights and so forth. Well, on the way to Cairo, I started to feel fine again. It was like all my life force came back. And I was okay. And I knew I was okay. And so then I'm in bed that night and I'm thinking, I've got a flight tomorrow, but why am I taking that flight? I feel great. I don't want to go to North Carolina and feel great. I want to be in Egypt and feel great. You know, I still had, so I changed everything all again. Patricia was so flexible and sweet. And Jocelyn helped me actually think about what I might do, which was go to Giza. And so that's what I did. I went to Giza and got a little hotel room there. And there I was with the pyramids for the next 5 days all by myself. And I realized this was part of what the plan was for me to have this sort of death-like experience and then to try to assimilate it in a very quiet place in Giza. You know, it's like a cool place to be assimilating your massive experience. And so I wouldn't have chosen, this is not the trip I had thought I was gonna have or chosen, but here I was alone. And I felt like I was in completely other reality there. I felt like the guides were really working with me to help me to assimilate and understand this sort of death and resurrection ritual that had been prepared and that I was able to experience.
Yes. Wow. And it was all, and there were so many layers. There were so many, even more layers than what you've shared here, right? There was so much happening. And wow. What a powerful experience.
Right, Jocelyn. You know,
you can't even encapsulate it. No
right. I wish I could tell you. One of the things that's interesting is when I really felt like I wasn't even sure I was breathing. And I just want to say, I wasn't scared for a second. There wasn't even an atom, not a cell of fear or like, I'm really going to die. I never thought that. It just so you know, there wasn't that. But there was a time at that place where I felt like I was like in a gray sort of slate room. Like it was all gray, it was smooth stone. That's where I was. There was no fluffy, comforting fields of, you know, whatever. It was stone cold and not uncomfortable, just that's what it was. And then at the end of the trip, we went into the king's chamber and I thought, this is where I was. Mm-hmm. It was like this. It was gray, smooth stone, big room. This is where I was. And I wonder, you know, if it took me back to a time of that. And I thought, this is what they used to do in those death rituals. They used to bring you to a place where you were, your life force was gone. And they knew how to do this. And it's not scary. It's not uncomfortable even. It's just what they're doing. And you go into that place and you don't get to take any of your concepts, any of the things you think you know, you don't get to take any of that with you. All of that is gone. Your sense of identity, everything is gone and you're in this place. And I thought that was like the king's chamber.
And that's what's, I mean, that's just at the core, that's at the heart of Egypt, right? That's what's written in the pyramid text. That's what the Isis and Osiris mythology is about. That's what the pharaohs would go through every so often to prove their fitness to be in that position as pharaoh. Like, it's incredible, this death and rebirth that you went through.
It is. And the thing that's really interesting is, you know all that. I didn't know that. I'm not, like I said, I'm not a student. I hadn't studied it. I was there to learn. And I didn't know that. I learned more about it in the last 2 days of your event here. You and Veronica and Patricia, mm-hmm. and realizing that's what I would, you know, I didn't even know.
Yeah.
But I sensed, I remember thinking, this is what they did. They did this. They yes. knew how to bring you to this place. And I don't know how they took me to the place, because I honestly don't think I was sick. I think there was some other energetic rewiring thing that was going on with me that took me to that place. And it was, you know, the doctor didn't know what to say. Nobody knew what to say or how to understand it.
Yeah.
Least of all myself, but I knew to surrender to it and trust it.
Yeah. So what does this mean for all of us? What can we interpret, and what are you interpreting from?
Well, it's just the beginning now, and I'm excited about it. But my sense is, Jocelyn, that this is about understanding death. We have no idea what death is. We have no idea. It is not what we think it is. It is and that's where the false door thing is. That you can pass in and out of that realm of the dead. We can, and they can, and If I am dead tomorrow, Jocelyn, don't think I'm gone. I'm not. I'm here. That's what I really realize. I will not be gone. I don't want anybody to think I'm gone, because I'll be here. And it's such a loss to the soul of the one who passes over to think that they're not here, because they're here. And so for us to relate to them, feed them in whatever way, and call on them and be in connection. And that's what ancient Egypt was about, is this connection with the dead. This was really important. Death was such a big part of life that they were building these massive pyramids and tombs and all of these stories to tell about the life that happens once we exit this incarnation, and the ways that we can go in and out of that realm of the dead, even as we're alive and incarnated. That's a lot of it. And I feel like this knowledge needs to come back to us now for a lot of reasons. You know, we don't know what's coming on this planet yet, you know, in terms of climate change, in terms of solar activity. We don't know what's coming. But for us to understand death and to really get back in touch with those beloved friends and family members and colleagues that, you know, have gone over to be in touch with death and not to fear it. I had when I was working on my dissertation, I wish I could say who wrote this. Sorry to the person that I can't quote the name, but I remember reading, and it made a big impression on me, that he said that the most repressed theme of the 19th century was sex. Very repressed, you know, very Victorian kind of like, ooh. And he said the most, we got over that, but the most repressed theme of the next century was death. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Everybody was afraid of it. You know, if you cried even at a funeral, that you were admonished, you know, and people were doing the plastic surgery and all the things to not have, you know, any kind of indication that of aging and death. And so it's like, it's been in our collective mind, it's been a very sort of misunderstood and even, you know, thought of as a bad thing. And it's such an important part of life. So, you know, and I think that to understand death is to tell us how to live. You know, anyone who has had any of those experiences of going over, come back and they know how to live in a different way. They understand the values, the priorities, the importance, the sort of magic, and they appreciate it in a different way. So it's not just about understanding death, it's understanding life because of it, understanding death, that it's, you know, it's two sides of the same coin, and you can't have one without the other. And we've tried to just repress or suppress or put away, you know, that death. So I feel like that's part of it.
This is reminding me of something that I've heard from two different people now. I interviewed Brooke Medicine Eagle at one point, and she said the people, I believe this was in Nepal, although I'm not sure, but she said, when a child is born, they mourn and they say, oh, you know, we're so sad for you. You have to come into this physical body now. And when somebody dies, they celebrate, and it's, oh, you're going back to the oneness. You're going back to who you really are. Right. And then also I heard, so Matthias Di Stefano, who, you know, has memories of past lives in Atlantis and ancient Egypt and everything, he was talking recently, and he said, I have the notes here. He said, when we were, yeah, I don't know if this was in Atlantis times or ancient Egypt times, but it was something like really, really far back. He said, we would tell the children, like, death was something you would look forward to. He said, we will tell the children, remember, someday you will die and it will be amazing. You will be free again, right? So there's this very different reality around death. And we've been taught that it's this horrible thing and it's the end and there's nothing after this. And the science, what science can tell, is just not the whole picture at all. Not even close.
Not even close. I mean, science finally now is coming back around to understanding the non-physical aspect of our being. But for too long, science was just about the physical. And then if it wasn't something you could get on a microscope, it didn't exist or it didn't matter. Right. And so, you know, they're now experimenting enough that they can start to pick up the non-physical in other ways. But this is one. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know you had a meditation to share. Did you want to share that? Do you think there's time for it?
Yeah, I
20 minutes.
If there's anything I wanted to say before.
If there's anything else you wanted to say.
Yeah, let me just say a couple other things. So we have a little more time. We have
about 20 minutes.
20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to just end with the meditation, if that's all right.
Sure.
So the only thing I wanted to say is that I feel like we can be called to, in our quiet moments, accept the reality of these false doors, you know, what they represent to us, that we can go in and out, and that this, and that the silence that one experiences in that way can be with us even when we're, you know, like we're sitting and talking right now, but that silence can be like bigger than what our little minds are doing and what our, you know, our bodies are coming up with words and so forth. So that silence can actually be with us even as we're navigating our very incarnated and busy lives. And so that it's like, it's about claiming and accepting that aspect of our being and really being in touch with that element of reality and the world. And I also just wanted to describe too the sort of resurrection part of this. You know, we think of resurrection as the exciting part. I think the death is also the exciting part, but the resurrection part is a challenge because you have to recompose. You know, for me, it was like taking back my assumptions, my concepts, my identity, you know, the things I, you know, to be able to even talk. It took me some weeks. And as the spirits that organized this for me created it for me, I had Christmas alone this year. My kids were all with other elements of the family. And so I had Christmas. So I had 8 days when I got home that was alone too. And so all of that has been really valuable in terms of integrating all of it. But it's the reassembly. And I'm thinking of my little grandson, Stokely, when he puts together the Lego things, you know, and then takes them all apart. And then he makes something else completely different. And then he takes it all apart. And I think we can kind of do that with our own sort of mind and assumptions and identity and so forth, that it can be all disassembled. And then it's nothing there. It's just a bunch of pieces, you know, like the little coffee can, you know. But when you put it back together, it's like these assumptions are helpful for me to get through, you know, this job that I'm doing, or this, you know, going to the doctor, or, you know, being a grandmother or whatever. These assumptions are helpful now, but they can be disassembled and aren't the reality. It's like this reality that we think is real is not real. And I think that's part of the resurrection process, is to realize all of that can be assembled and reassembled, and it's not real. It has no more reality than like that little spaceship that Stokely builds, you know, with the Legos. It's no more real. All that we think is real here is no more real than that. You can disassemble it and it's not there. And so to kind of understand that what we think of as real is not real, that there's something else. There's something more. And that other, that more is all this potential, all this universal vast potential of who we are and what we can be in touch with, that is so exciting that we have really gotten into this sort of sad place of the reality that we have created by eliminating that sort of land of silence and of the dead. And, you know, they say in the beginning was the word. That's sort of where the Bible begins, you know, and it's like the word is the sort of limitation then of all that. You know, the words are, I just read recently, words are spells. You know, it's like a word is spell casting. And it's almost like in the beginning was the word was the spell casting of us coming into matter. And if we take away the words, we can shatter the illusion and break the spell, that there's some kind of spell we're under in this use of words, and we need to be really impeccable, you know, with how we even think words, much less, you know, impart them or cast them on ourselves. You know, the words that we use against ourselves can be really they're, you know, really dangerous. So it's casting a spell on ourselves. So, and then I just also wanted to say, I have been so fascinated for a long time about Celtic mythology, and the Celts have this thing about how the Danu, who was one of the goddesses in the Celtic world, and I learned through her, she was the queen of the Tuatha De Danann. I don't know if I say that right, but they're like the fairy folk, and they say that her people, when the Christians came and were imposing a certain ideology on their world that was denigrating it and wanted to dismantle it, they decided to go into the other realm and live there. And that's who the fairy people are. And they say they turn sideways into the light and they live on this other side of reality. And so I've often thought about that. This connects to that. That's part of the false door thing. And in Giza, I was in another reality for for those 5 days. I went sideways into some other dimension, and that's where I was. And so it's possible to do that and then come back, and then you have to reassemble yourself. So yeah, that was just sort of finishing up some of the thoughts that I had. And now if we can.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for this, Tarya. And I think that part you said about, this reality is not real. Right. And there's so much more for us. I think that's just one of the key lessons of Egypt. And we just can't even fully grasp that, we can try. There's so many layers to it and levels to it and so many different realities.
Right, right.
It's just a really vast
dimensional beings. That's our identity. That's who we really are these interdimensional beings. And it's amazing how my mind was scrambled just by being there. Everything was relativized, and everything I thought I knew was not real or true or necessary. It was all kind of cute, but it wasn't necessary. So, there's something that ancient Egypt has for us. And I think it's great that we're giving it some, space in our thoughts and minds now to integrate what it has for us. So.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you for this really powerful story and journey. And I know you have a wonderful free gift for everybody. So I want to make sure to mention that too before we go into the meditation,
okay.
Which is our Global Dream Symposium. So if you would want to say a few words about it, I can put the comment in the link in the chat.
Yes. Jocelyn and I, for more than 5 years now, have been on a monthly basis, conducting on a Friday at 1 o'clock Eastern time, one Friday a month. You can get the schedule on either of our websites. We have a dream symposium where people come from all over the world and we listen into the collective messages of the dreaming that speak with guidance and perspective and information and wisdom for the community. And Jocelyn and I started this when we were thinking about the indigenous people who get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and listen to each other's dreams. And that's how they start their day. And that's how they conduct the business of the people, is to understand what the dreams are saying, because they're telling what we need to know, what we really need to know, more than the New York Times in the morning. The dreams are telling a whole different level of what we need to know. Although I read the Times and I love it. But so Jocelyn and I created this so that we could start to do what the indigenous people did, which is listen into the dreaming and discern the guidance that's coming to us through the village in that way. So everyone's invited, it's free, and you're welcome to come. And I also wanted to say, I have on my website, I have a whole list on the videos page. I have a whole list of recordings if anybody wants to listen to any of the other things that I've been offering lately, as well as my dissertation is on there. A lot of articles are on there. So if anybody would like to, poke around in there, there's free gifts there too.
Yes, there's a wealth of inspiration there for sure. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Tarya. And mm-hmm. you can share the meditation if you think we have time, whenever you're ready.
I think we have just a few minutes. I think that'll be fine. Okay. It's just a few minutes. If you'd put that picture of the other side of the planet up, the water.
Oh, sure.
Pacific. Okay, so I'm going to invite everyone to feel your sit bones. And feel the chakra system, the crown chakra reaching out to the energy of the starry cosmos, the sit bones reaching to the core of the earth. knowing ourselves to be these beings in touch with all of these dimensions. And feeling that aspect of ourselves that this beautiful picture of the Pacific Ocean represents, that great silence that we are part of. And that is us. Every cell in our body is mostly space. We are that. It is us. And then this beautiful globe that we are sitting upon now, to realize that this globe is not only turning on its axis at a very quick rate, I don't know the numbers there, but it is also traveling around the sun at 66,000 miles an hour. So as we sit here, we are moving 66,000 miles an hour around the sun. And because of this beautiful membrane of our atmosphere, we don't even feel the breeze. But that is our reality. And now realize that the sun is moving 500,000 miles an hour through space. So we are moving 66,000 miles an hour around the sun. The sun itself is moving 500,000 miles an hour through space. We are on this journey. Our galaxy is moving. And there are 2 trillion other galaxies moving like this, all in this massive harmony. They're not slamming into each other. They're moving in this massive cosmic harmony. And we are part of that. That is part of us. So now, as we come back together, and as we go about our days, to keep somewhere in our cellular system these awarenesses, to know who we really are, and to know the relativity of the things that challenge and torment us, that have their purpose in our development, in our life. But to stay with the silence as well, and let it soothe and help us. Aho.
Thank you so much, Tarya. Thank you, for all you've shared here for this beautiful meditation.
Thank you. Well, it's been a delight, and I'll look forward to reading the chat column after. I love that that you published that so that.
Yeah, absolutely, of course. And I put your free gift there in the chat one more time so everybody can navigate there if they would like to. And yeah, thank you so much. And wonderful to have you here as a part of Into the Mythica.
Yeah, I look forward to spending the next days together. All of our hearts and minds are involved in this amazing journey you're bringing us all along with, Jocelyn. Thank you so much for who you are and how you do it. It's a marvel. Thank I always say Jocelyn's a force of nature.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody who's on live with us here, and also those who are watching this as a recording. I hope you've received so much from this beautiful, beautiful interview with Tarya. And definitely check out our other replays from today and other pre-recorded interviews that were posted today. We have some really, really beautiful ones. Go to the conference schedule page and you can find everything there, all the replays, all the free gifts. So enjoy, everybody. And I'll see you back tomorrow for day 4. We'll be starting around 10 a.m. New York time. So can't wait to see you all then.
And the beautiful Anne Baring is today too. I just really can't wait to hear her sharing.
Yes, she is so amazing. She turned 90 earlier this year, and wow, she has been sharing this visionary wisdom since long before everybody was all tuned into it, and she is still shifting our perspectives. So really amazing. She's definitely check out Anne Baring's. Yeah.
That's Anne. Yeah.
Yeah. She's a force of nature.
For those who don't know, she wrote The Myth of the Goddess and The Dream of the Cosmos. I mean, she's highly respected and often quoted, and has sort of shifted the consciousness on the planet just all by her little beautiful self. So, yeah.
She really has. Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, we covered a lot of ground in that interview, too. It's a really good one. So, definitely tune in for Anne Baring and all the others from today. Yeah. Well, enjoy, everybody, and I'll see you tomorrow. Many blessings, much love. Mwah. Take care. See you all soon.